2 weeks ago, we had a service right here on the practice of forgiveness. I left that service with you all feeling like there was still so much more that we could talk about. For example, on her way out that day, one of you brought up, what about forgiveness in the context of all the Catholic priests recently guilty of sexual abuse? That had been on my mind too. As well as a recent article by one of my seminary professors asking, in the midst of the Me Too movement, why our culture often rushes so quickly to forgive male perpetrators of assault. Who are we more likely to easily forgive, and why? What hurts in our world need to be listened to longer before the call to forgive and reconcile? And what is the role of justice in the forgiveness process? So I changed my sermon topic for today so we can consider forgiveness and justice. During the ongoing Me Too movement, prominent men and occasionally a woman have been accused of wrongdoing. Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Morgan Freeman, the list goes on and on. And there has sometimes been worry over whether some of the consequences these men have faced have swung the pendulum too far. Morgan Freeman himself said, "I am devastated that 80 years of my life is at risk of being undermined in the blink of an eye by Thursday's media reports." Some find themselves wondering, is the end of a career too high a price to pay? What if it was just offensive comments and not technical assault? Emily Click from Harvard Divinity School says, "This argument runs the risk of perpetuating an old harm done, not just by victimizers, but also by the rest of us. What we as a society have failed to do and need now to repent is to count the price victims have paid." I understand the call to right and proper forgiveness, she says. I would ask, however, that we wait to make such a call. Instead, it is a time for listening. So too, in the most recent Catholic clergy abuse scandal, it's clear that many high-ranking officials privileged their colleagues' careers and privacy over ever truly listening to the victims. I bet that one reason we have not stopped to really listen is because it's uncomfortable. How many times do even we ourselves turn away from the news articles saying it's just too much? If we really listen to victims' pain and the ways their lives have been affected, what hard truths would we have to confront in our culture, in the human condition, in ourselves? So in some ways, what I'm talking about today is about communal forgiveness, about times our whole culture must wrestle with dis-ease within it, and when instead of really facing the pain, we rush too quickly to a quick and cheap forgiveness, which is not true forgiveness at all, or we rush to retributive, punitive justice, which is usually not justice at all. Desmond Tutu has this fourfold path of forgiveness that I talked about 2 weeks ago. I talked about the fourth step. The first two steps of forgiveness, he says, are telling the story and naming the hurt, acknowledging the pain. So how often do we, as individuals and as a culture, skip these steps? How often do we look away from the gritty details? How practiced are we at naming hurts? These are Tutu's requirements for acknowledging the pain. So these can be hard to do even when we're just listening to a friend's pain, much less someone we don't know, or someone whose pain brings up triggers within us, brings up political values that we may have. Do not try to fix, do not minimize, do not offer advice. Again, how practiced are we at naming hurts, at facing the truth of pain? In our country, we have never had a truth and reconciliation process, for example, related either to the decimation of Native peoples or to our hideous history of slavery. We have never faced those truths, really, as a country. We expect the ancestors of these Native and African American people to just move on, to let it go, even though it has been proven that trauma lives on psychologically, passed down in our genes to ancestors, and that the economic and social costs of colonialism and slavery have never been recouped. So I think the call to reparations, to somehow practically repay Native and African American people for all that was taken from them, is not even as scary as the truth process that would be required to determine the scale of those reparations. In terms of facing the truth, Hannah Arendt says, "True forgiveness is achieved in community, and it can be accomplished only in truth. That truth, however, is not mere knowledge, it is acknowledgement. It is a coming to terms with, and it is a labor." Hannah Arendt should know. She was a Jewish philosopher living during the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, she covered the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who the New York Times had labeled the most evil monster of humanity. Based on her observations at the trial, her facing of the truth, she determined that he was not the most evil monster. She said that any evil that lived in him also lived in us. She coined the phrase the banality of evil, banality meaning normal, everyday. She said we are all capable of contributing to evil conditions by going with the flow, not evaluating the consequences of our seemingly trivial actions. Maybe some of you have seen this picture. Anyone seen this picture and know where it was taken and when? So these are staff working at Auschwitz in 1944. So we all know what was going on when this picture was being taken. So these were staff just doing their job out on a break, getting caught in the rain and laughing. We all like to think that we would not be these people, that we would be able to clearly face the truth of the evil going on around us and do whatever it took to not participate in it. But would we, I wonder? Do we? So what kind of spiritual practices do we need in order to develop our ability to face the truth, to listen to pain, to understand our own complicity in the suffering around us, and to create true justice and forgiveness? I think this is one of the hard truths we face when we truly listen to the voices of victims, the truth that pain in this world is not isolated and discrete. It's not over there separate from me, that story that my friend told me. Pain travels along the interdependent web that connects all of us, and healing that pain, preventing more pain, requires all of us to turn and face it among us and within us. So this truth about pain is the rationale behind a different sort of justice process called restorative justice. Excuse me, one of my pregnancy symptoms is I get really out of breath. So our criminal system uses retributive justice, which looks at what laws were broken and what punishment the perpetrator must receive. But here's how Desmond Tutu, who was part of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, describes restorative justice. As restorative justice begins from the premise that a crime is an act not against the state, but against another person and against the community. In this model of justice, accountability is based on the offender taking responsibility, both for the harm they have caused and for taking action to repair the hurt. Victims are not peripheral to this process of justice, but play an integral role in deciding what is needed to repair the harm and the fabric of the community. Restorative justice seeks to recognize the humanity in each of us, whether we are victims or perpetrators. And forgiveness is central to restorative justice. So breaking the cycles of pain and violence in our world requires both true justice and real forgiveness. So I'll close with a story from our own UU universe about restorative justice. Last year, Barbara Hanley and I went to New Orleans for General Assembly, the annual gathering of Unitarian Universalists. On the final morning of worship, our newly elected president, Susan Frederick Gray, interrupted worship to say that the night before, two UUA staff people, Tim Byrne and James Curran, were violently robbed and severely injured in the French Quarter. Tim was in critical condition. The four suspects were black youth, aged 18 to 21. Two turned themselves in, and three had been residents at a shelter for young adults at risk. The shocking and bloody incident was caught on surveillance camera, and it quickly became such a viral video that New Orleans city officials worried that the story would deter potential tourists to the French Quarter. So that morning, when President Susan Frederick Gray made her announcement, she said, "I want to acknowledge the sorrow, fear, anger, and heartbreak of seeing a loved one, a member of our community, violently attacked. Throughout this General Assembly, we've reflected on the narratives and wider systems of oppression that perpetuate both systemic and personal violence. This week, those reflections became personal and proximate." You see, just the night before, right before these two men were attacked, our Ware lecturer, defense attorney Brian Stevenson, had talked about the inequities in our prison system and the hard paths that lead there. He said there are four essential things we must do to create a more just and equal world: get proximate to the poor, the excluded, neglected, and abused, change the narratives that underlie racism and other inequalities, stay hopeful about creating justice, and be willing to do uncomfortable things. So here we were all faced with one of those uncomfortable things. That morning, President Susan Frederick Gray invited us to hold the attackers with the universal love we also hold for James and Tim. I don't think that's an example of cheap forgiveness, like I was talking about, of rushing too quickly to forgive, like we sometimes do with the Me Too men or the cover-ups in the Catholic sexual abuse scandal. We have to ask the question, whose pain are we listening to? Whose freedoms or livelihoods are we defending? Is it only the people who have already experienced lives of privilege and power? And are we privileging their stories first before listening to the pain of the victims? The victims in this case were certainly in pain. Tim Byrne was unconscious for 24 hours after the attack. He never remembered what happened to him or the 2 to 3 days afterwards. And the doctors were afraid he might die. His fellow staff at the UUA and the local UU congregation in New Orleans reached out to provide comfort and practical aid over the many months that he underwent physical, occupational, and speech therapy. And he's only finally now back to work full time. But a few months after the attack, he says that one of his coworkers, Elizabeth Nguyen, who's the senior strategist for our UU Side with Love campaign, brought up to him the idea of restorative justice. Tim said that both he and his husband both quickly felt like this sounds better than anything the criminal justice system could do. Tim said he learned the four men were of the age where they were deeply affected by Hurricane Katrina and were displaced, and that they had aged out of foster care and had been living in a shelter. And he also learned that the UU group in New Orleans was collecting money each month so the defendants could purchase soap and shampoo in the jail. He said, "Wait a minute, they have to pay for soap? That's not a luxury. So that crystallized for me, he said, that prison is just not humane. He and James, the other victim, both wrote letters to the court advocating for restorative justice. He hoped that he and James and their families could meet with the defendants. He hoped there would be some kind of monitored transition where the young men were put on a disciplined and overseen path to make improvements, whether that be education, training, job skills, substance abuse, counseling. He said, I'd rather that they not go to jail. My sense is that that is not a system that's going to improve people. But unfortunately, the prosecutors were dismissive, saying, yeah, that's not going to happen. They're probably going to get 20 years. So Tim wrote a second letter explaining that recidivism statistics show that incarceration doesn't stop criminal activity, but creates more of it. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, a group of about 30 UUs had been working to encourage also the restorative justice process on the case, meeting with the defense attorneys and the DA, writing letters to the judge. They provided the young men in jail with books, as well as money to buy soap. And with Tim and James' permission, 10 or more UUs attended each court hearing over the past year, often showing up in our iconic yellow Side with Love shirts or Black Lives Matter shirts. Well, unfortunately, despite all these efforts, the story didn't end the way they hoped. The young men were each sentenced to 5 to 8 years in prison for each charge. Tim and James did feel that these sentences were less than if they hadn't gotten involved, but they were still disappointed. President Susan Frederick Gray acknowledged this disappointment, as well as our commitment to keep up the work. She said, "We heal the wound while we are in the wound, fighting for a world of fewer wounds, fewer wounds." So I'll end with one takeaway about how we can translate this kind of communal restorative justice process to our own everyday lives. Here are the elements for an effective apology. What would it mean, even as a spiritual practice, if we all got really good at giving apologies? So people have done studies and actually found that these six elements make for a good apology. So a common understanding of what happened, and this doesn't have to be complicated. You can do one sentence for each of these. Yesterday on the phone, I said such and such. I spoke without thinking. Acknowledgement of pain. I understand that that hurt you. I was insensitive. I'm sorry I said that. Offer of repair. How can I make it right? Or in the future, I'll be more mindful. So we can see here some of the things that we've been talking about. Acknowledgement of pain. Facing pain that we've caused, pain in the world, and offering repair, like restorative justice. I don't expect you to memorize that. I'll put it on our Facebook page, though, if you want to come back to it and practice it. So the good news is that we have opportunities every day to practice this. We have opportunities every day to get better at facing the hurts in the world, at understanding our own responsibility, at working for true justice and finding real forgiveness for ourselves and for others. And what a blessing it is to do this work together. May it be so.